soccer has been on the mind this summer. People have been riled up over the World Cup, which ended yesterday in a victory for France. Kansas City soccer fans have been following the whole thing, but closer to home, Sporting KC just kicked off a new season, and clubs and recreational teams have tons of players and fans. It's a real scene. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're looking at the history of soccer in Kansas City, starting with our producer, Suzanne Hogan.
It's crazy to think about how big soccer has gotten in Kansas City, because it hasn't always been that way.
Salvador?
Pásale, adelante. Salvador Gómez.
Nice to meet you.
Mi amigo Armando Díaz.
Hola.
Hola, ¿cómo estás?
Muy bien.
Yes,
soy Susana.
Susana, mucho gusto.
Mucho gusto.
I met up with two old players who were part of Kansas City's first soccer team, a team called Los Latinos.
Salvador Gómez, I'm 74 years old. Yo jugué de defensa y de portero.
Armando Díaz, I'm 82 years old, and I play defense and goalie.
This was back in the 1950s. Actually, my grandpa, Jose Portuguez, who's from Costa Rica, was also a part of this team.
¿Es su abuelo?
Sí.
Oh, no sabía. Ah. ¿Cómo está él?
Muy bien.
Jose Portuguez, he was one of our coaches, as a matter of fact, him and Chino Medina.
Salvador and Armando are both from Mexico originally. Armando arrived in Kansas City when he was 17. That's when he met other Latinos who had immigrated here who also wanted to play the game. Los Latinos got together on Sundays and played at a park on the west side or at Swope Park. He says in those early years, most people in Kansas City didn't know much about the game.
They thought we were crazy when we started kicking the ball. Well, they used to call it kickball. I said, no, that's not kickball, that's football.
Los Latinos team got bigger and bigger, and then another team formed, Los Internacionales, which was a team made up of European immigrants from Germany, France, Hungary, Croatia. The two teams would play each other pretty regularly.
When we first started, there was no uniforms here. I went to Mexico to pick up the first uniforms for the international. El emblema y todo lo mandamos a hacer en México, porque aquí no había nada. No había balones, no había nada.
Wait, so you had to go to Mexico,
yeah,
and to bring balls and uniforms.
So, yeah, there was nothing here, nothing.
And from nothing, a football community was born in Kansas City.
This is what kept us together at that time, you know, because foreign country, and so what kept us together was the soccer, the football. And the Europeans didn't speak English either, and we didn't speak English. So the only thing that kept us together was the little ball right there. It's kicking the ball, because that's the only language that we knew.
By the time Suzanne was growing up in Kansas City, there were neighborhood leagues. And even that was a far cry from what her grandpa found soccer-wise when he arrived, when there were no balls or uniforms to be found. Now, the sport's totally taken off with competitive professional teams and everything. We'll hear more about that side of it later in the show, but for now, Chris Medina is here with me. He's the executive director of the Guadalupe Centers. And Chris, your dad was one of those people who introduced soccer to Kansas City back in the day.
Yeah, my father immigrated to this country in Kansas City in 1953. But when he came, there was a team established. It was called Guadalupe. That was the first Latino soccer team. They were co-sponsored by the church, Our Lady Guadalupe Church. In fact, one of the parish priests played on the team with them, with most of the immigrants. And the priest, in fact, he was from Spain. So in Spain, they played soccer, of course. And so the team was established. And the person that helped organize that team was Ignacio Orozco.
You know, I mean, do you have the feeling, just looking back on this history, like soccer is international, except until recently in North America?
Yeah, Kansas City's been playing soccer now for some time, but the challenge with the United States has been you have so many other sports, and most of these other countries, soccer is the sport. Where here, you're vying for athletes for all the other sports, and truly, it's not the national pastime yet.
Well, so when you were a kid and your dad, we heard about him when we were talking to those other guys, he was Chino Medina, right?
Yeah. My father played 10 years professional soccer in Mexico. He was a scoring champion in the Mexican League twice. He came to Kansas City because my mother was from Kansas City, and they decided to move to Kansas City because she wanted to be closer to her family. But he had the soccer experience, so when he came and he found it, he wanted to continue the sport, he found this group of team called Guadalupe, and later they became Los Latinos. Yes.
Do you remember going to games and stuff as a kid?
Oh, yeah, no question. In the late 50s, I was born in 51, so there wasn't a lot of teams. In Kansas City, I think there was just Los Latinos and the Internationals. But then we'd go to Park College, and we'd go to Ottawa College, and they'd go to Whiteman Air Force Base to play games in the region. I also remember going with them to Des Moines. There was a soccer club made up of Polish people in Des Moines. I remember going to Omaha and Storz Beer at the time, and there was a German team there. And in Wichita, there was another Mexican team. So I remember taking those trips that we'd go to those cities, and they would come to Kansas City and play here.
How formal were these leagues? I mean, I find it really interesting that communities of soccer players from all over the world somehow found each other to start playing against one another, kind of, but with one another too, in the Midwest, throughout the Midwest.
You know, Kansas City wasn't real diverse. I mean, and so where you could find pockets of immigrants, you were going to find soccer because that was their national pastime. That was their form of recreation. And I think you heard in one of the earlier interviews that sport, that recreation brought people together. The language was, you know, English was a language here, but most of those people did not speak English. And so it was even hard for them to communicate. That game brought people together to share experience and to come together.
Tell me more about your dad, Chino Medina. You said he was a professional. He was on the national team in Mexico.
Yes, he played he signed as a professional at age of 17. And he played for five different clubs in Mexico. He retired at the age of 30, and that's kind of young, but my mom said, hey, I think that's enough. You guys, she wanted him to settle down, and as a result, he retired. And they lived in Mexico City for the first 3 years of their marriage. He played, unfortunately, he got to play on the national team a couple times, but that was there was no World Cup during that period because you're right around World War II, and so those cups were suspended.
Can you tell me more about his life when he first arrived in Kansas City beyond his involvement in soccer and,
sure,
and changing the culture around soccer?
Well, it was very difficult for him. He came here. He was in Mexico. He was a celebrity. People knew him. He had a decent job and worked hard and as a result, they had a comfortable living. He came here basically because my mother was very depressed, and she'd been born here. My mother's family had been here in Kansas City since 1919. She wanted to come home. He came, and so it was very hard for him. Didn't know the language. There was nobody to play soccer. He couldn't find anybody. There was no leagues. There was no teams that he could go try out for.
And nobody to know he had been a big deal.
Right. He was just Joe Blow from or Juan Hernandez from Kansas City, from Mexico. People, yeah, they didn't know who he was or his status. So, but the players, it was funny because the players that he played with, they couldn't believe. They had read about my dad and heard about him in the publications. So when they saw him coming to play on their club team, they were like blown away. It's like one of the former Royals going to play for, you know, a local baseball team.
Yeah. Coming, joining the T-ball circuit.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, but where does the name Chino come from?
Oh, he had curly hair. Chino means curly in Spanish.
Huh.
So he had real curly locks, yeah.
But back to soccer, I mean, so he was on a team called Los Latinos.
Correct.
And they played a European team called Los Internacionales.
Right. Good team. They had players from all over Europe. I remember very intense games. It was a good rivalry. Good rivalry.
Well, we heard about your, like, that there were people who would travel back to Mexico to get, like, basic supplies for soccer to be played in Kansas City where they weren't readily found, like balls and uniforms. It seems like there must not have been much of a structure for this thing. Like they were going to have to do it all themselves.
And they did. Even from the field where they practiced, I mean, the field that they used at the time at Gage Park was a small field, didn't even meet the requirements or measurements for a soccer field. They were instrumental in going to the city to get the first designated soccer field in Kansas City. Went to the mayor and city council at the time back in the 50s. They asked for a field, and what the mayor did and the council was they gave him a field over at Gillum Park. So the first soccer field in Kansas City was at Gillum Park. They didn't even have goals. I remember I got a picture of the soccer field, and they got the soccer goals are made out of pipe plumbing pipes.
That they dragged there themselves?
That the city actually put up for them, but it was, we got metal pipes. That's not real safe, but that's what they used. They played there for years until later when the first field at Swope Park was also part of their efforts to get fields over there. And when they did play at Swope Park, I remember even then the goals, they were still not designated regular goals because they used a number of 2x4s and the goals would sag in the middle.
You were saying earlier that they were like playing teams though as far away as Des Moines. I mean, to get a group of adults like on a bus or van or something?
That's what they do. It was a big deal. We'd go up there, take a field trip. I remember going on bus excursions, and we'd go up there for the weekend. And it was so nice because when we went to Omaha, we went to a brewery, German beer, German food.
How old were you?
Oh, I was young, but I mean, my parents would. And of course, they didn't get to enjoy the product at the time, but the food was fantastic. And we would do the same. When we would host those teams come in, they would do a celebration, rent a hall. They'd do a tournament, a four-team tournament. Really nice.
What about the next generation? I mean, for you, by the time you were playing soccer, was the soccer culture here different? Did your friends, beyond like the kids of these other players, know about soccer?
They did and they didn't. A lot of the kids that I grew up with were Mexican-American. They were born here. They hadn't played soccer. They hadn't seen it other than what they saw maybe in the Pearl. What was unique to our community was our immigration never stopped for its Latinos, not just for Mexicans, but for other Central Americans and South Americans. And so when those immigrants would come to Kansas City, they'd find out about our teams. I remember the team that I played for, it was called Atlas, and it was after a team that my dad played for. We had players from Colombia, from Peru, of course from Mexico, and even a couple of Brazilians. And so they came, most of them were students that had been relocated or their families had moved here. And so once again, the game brought them together. And so there you had infusion of local kids who had never played before, other than maybe watching their parents or their uncles play, and then the new kids coming in. That was also a place for us to come together with the immigrant kids to associate and work, get to know them.
Do you think that it is important for just the general population of Kansas City to know this history?
No question. People don't think, they think it just maybe sprung up here recently, and that's great. Kansas City now has soccer. It's probably, I think, it's most popular sport for the amateur ranks with the numbers, and that's great. But they don't have the history of soccer documented very well in this city. So I think it's important. Just like they do for the Negro League museums and baseball, well, there's a rich history here of soccer, and people need to know about it.
What do you think is the bigger story that history tells, like for your community, for its role in the city?
Well, one, how the sport initiated and how hard it was for them to, to continue the sport. Everybody, at the time when a lot of these people immigrated, they were wanting them to assimilate. Well, like I said, soccer wasn't being played very much in the United States at that time. They much would rather have had them play baseball or basketball or other sports.
And if they'd assimilated, maybe we wouldn't be playing soccer so much now.
Could be. It would be taking longer for us to play. But that was important to continue the sport and to look where it's at now. It's really flourished.
Do you feel like personally proud when you see that, when you see what's happened to soccer in
Kansas City? No question. Yeah. And there's a big part of our history that had it not been for the efforts of, my dad and his friends and other people, maybe the sport hadn't taken off.
So one of the things that has taken off is kids leagues, and I'm going to turn now to Peter Sloan, who's seen the transformation of one league, the Brookside Soccer League, from its humble beginnings as a neighborhood club to what it is now, which is basically a citywide youth organization. We want your memories, too. Have you witnessed changes in how Kansas City treats soccer? 816-235-2888 is the number to call to join this conversation. Peter Sloan, hello.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Just great.
You've been super involved in recreational soccer here in town for what, 20 years?
For probably longer than that.
But longer than that?
Yes.
Tell me about the history of the Brookside Soccer League and how you got involved, how it all started.
Well, the Brookside Soccer League really initiated back in 1977, and which late 60s, early 70s, there's a lot of kind of really grassroots youth organizations popping up, and it was really started by a couple dads in the Brookside area that really was all of two teams playing on Bingham Middle School's fields. And that's matured over the time. And I got involved when I had a child that was at the age, at age six, that wanted to play. And I actually grew up in New Jersey. And as it happened, I was the only father of that entire group that actually knew anything about the sport. So I was immediately told I was the head coach. And
you were designated?
Yes.
Just by being from New Jersey?
Precisely. Well, just knowing a little bit about soccer. And I played in high school, and so I grew up loving the sport. I actually had the opportunity of seeing Pelé's last game in the Meadowlands, and which was a sort of a monumental time. And so I inherited the opportunity of coaching a lot of these kids. And the neighborhood team that sort of grew became coach, became more involved in the league, and then I was asked to help run the league, and so I did that for almost 15 years, and I'm still involved at the board level. And what started out as a couple dads and a couple teams is now a total league-wide, about 2,800 players.
It's giant. I mean, I've been to Swope Park in that village on the weekends when all those kids are playing, and it is like a world unto itself.
It very much is, and it's, for me personally, it's exciting to see some New Jersey kid coming and watching how it's transformed. And the youth soccer, in many respects, has paralleled kind of the professional level ranks in Kansas City. And those two things have much to owe each other in terms of doing those things. And I do think...
In what sense, like the kids' enthusiasm for the sport helps provide the base, the fan base or something like that?
Without a doubt, if you begin to think about how the culture of soccer, as Chris was talking about, was really sort of invisible in this part of the country. And it wasn't until there was much more notable, kids could see other folks playing on television and have some athletes to aspire to, did they realize, that's an opportunity for me. And that was happening both on the boys' side, and then with the advent of the women's game, the girls were seeing that as well. And so all those things were really critical to helping nurturing, hey, this sounds like a really good sport. And that combined with the fact that from a physical education access level, soccer is probably one of the easiest sports to get into.
How did the Brookside Soccer League go from what it was, what you described, to this bigger thing? Is there like a milestone where it's like, this is a different thing now?
Well, I think Kansas City has been it does have a very rich history of soccer, and competitive soccer is a big piece of it. But the area that we as an organization focused on was the recreational side, and realizing, and particularly the area that fed the Brookside soccer was really sort of school driven. And so it was really recreational at its best, is about kids wanting to play together with friends. And so we sort of figured out what that recipe was in terms of school related teams, other kids, whether it's from from like charter schools, like Academy Lafayette, to homeschooling. So we managed to create an organization that allowed that to occur. And that was by nature pretty diverse. And that just, with a lot of great leadership and lots of volunteer energy over the years, has been able to continue to sustain that.
You know, I'm just going to admit, I was not an athletic kid, but most of my friends played on those teams, the early Brookside Soccer League teams. And what I remember is that they all wore these very specific blue and white reversible jerseys with like the breathing holes in them. And I hear that you have been an advocate of keeping those in circulation.
Well, that goes back to the brand of the organization, and the brand of any organization, as long as you stay true to that, allows you to not forget where you've been. And those jerseys, you know, at one point, you could only get them at the dime store over on 63rd Street.
Yeah, dime store.
And so you'd go in there and buy those elements. And we've grown past that. But for the kids that are truly young, the 4 and 5 year olds, those are still part of the uniform to honor kind of that history.
But the teams now have sponsors, I have noticed, and like sponsors' logos are on the jerseys.
We, as part of maturing as a club and you wanting to grow and being able to provide more benefits to all the participants, you link on with sponsors that are really critical. And that's been an evolution of the club that has benefited both all the youth that are playing, but also the club, because it allowed us to get some dollars to do some things we wouldn't otherwise be able to do.
So, like I mentioned, that I've been to the Swope Soccer Village on game weekends. One of the reasons that I think it's pretty cool has absolutely nothing to do with soccer, or maybe that's not the case, but it's one of the most diverse scenes I have encountered in Kansas City.
And I would agree, and I think what Chris was talking about earlier about the diversity, the thing about soccer, because it is international and it is something that every country in the world, for the most part, has a great affinity for, it naturally brings things together. And I think whether it's organized around a youth league or it's pickup games that are out there, the diversity is always on display. And again, like I mentioned, it's a really easy sport to get into. And that has been part of why the youth movement has grown over the years.
Chris Medina, I want to bring you back in on this. I mean, the diversity of people playing soccer today, what are your thoughts about that?
All you have to do is just look at recent World Cup TV. I mean, they show the scenes from all over the country, even in Kansas City, down at the Power and Light District. Even the United States was not in the tournament, but yet you had people finding their nationality. You had a large crowd there Sunday watching a French heritage that were there. I know when Mexico was playing, they were going down there. That's great. Truly, soccer is the world game.
Chris Medina, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And Peter Sloan, stay with me, okay?
Will do.
In just a minute, we'll turn our focus to the history of professional soccer in Kansas City later in the show, why Fairway City Hall has started opening up on weekends for Nerf gun wars. I'm Gina Kaufman.
Welcome back to Kemper Arena in Kansas City. We are being treated right now to one of the most spectacular light shows of pregame activities that I have ever witnessed. They are using mirrors and laser beams, and the theme is keep your eye on the sky, because here come the Kansas City Comets.
Wow, that is a blast from the past. Professional soccer in Kansas City has come a long way since the early 80s. Back then, we were known for pregame laser light shows, and I mean, the laser show was cool, but I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about the history of local soccer on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation with your stories and memories. 816-235-2888. Peter Sloan with the Brookside Soccer League since the early days. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And now let's bring in Rick Benben. He's been the head of the UMKC's soccer coaching team for the past 20 years, and he helped coach the Comets back in the day. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Good morning.
So that music must have taken you back.
No.
The sound of the early Comets games.
Right. Yeah, when I arrived here in Kansas City, and even the first game, I think I still remember, and the crowd, the lights, it was pretty amazing.
Forgive me if my memory of it is unfair, because I was like 8 when I went to those games, but even the announcers were pretty fixated on the laser show as far as like what matters about what's going on here.
No, for sure. I think that the Lewicki brothers in particular really created a environment that was just, something people had not seen before. So it was really unique from, the radio and TV guys to the definitely the people in the seats. It was just amazing.
Can you describe it for people who don't remember it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was really entertainment. So particularly the introduction of the players, we had seen it in St. Louis. They'd been in St. Louis with the Steamers and started it, but then they They even amplified it over here. So the lights would go down, the music would start.
The music, I've tried to find the music on YouTube and I could not, but
really?
Do I remember it correctly that it was like dun 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 dun?
Right,
dun.
Yeah, it's a theme from Midnight Express. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm guessing that that was not your focus as someone who helped coach the Comets.
No, we were knocked out by it. We were just all about, hey, collecting players, trying to put the very best team together that we could.
So, I mean, did it seem pretty radical to start a professional indoor soccer team here in the 1970s?
Oh, I'm sure. I think the league had started, I don't remember how long, you know, probably 2 or 3 years into the MISL when it came to Kansas City. But it had been, you know, it really blew up in St. Louis, where Pat McBride brought me over as his assistant to Kansas City. So we had seen it explode there, where the arena in St. Louis was full.
So they were like a test market for Kansas City.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. So then that the success in St. Louis really, you know, set a lot of interest across the country in the sport.
Peter Sloan, you were here. I mean, what's your memory of the overall soccer scene in Kansas City at that time?
Well, I think it was certainly growing, and I think the entertainment piece was that. And I think the Comets really paralleled what was going on in the NASL, WSL, which is the national scene. And like the New York Comets was a really big deal and had these high-level European commodities coming over here. So that caught the attention of the country, and a lot was going on, and the indoor soccer was part of that. And I think naturally that begun to sort of seep itself into the soccer scene. And, you know, early on I was raising a family, so that ultimately that's why I sort of became involved at the youth level. But the larger scene was just beginning to grow. Although I used to take my family out at Arrowhead when the original Wizards were playing out there. And again, it was not what it is today. And it was really
it was not what it is today.
It means as opposed to having a sold out stadium, 20,000 regularly, you had 8,000 to 10,000 in Arrowhead Stadium. And I remember specifically, you take my family, there was a Brazilian samba band that was part of the scene, and my family happened to be doing that at the time. So we were part of that, and that became our experience. It was an international experience within the Midwest around soccer.
But also almost like a subculture of soccer fans, not part of mainstream sports culture here.
And I think that's the history of soccer. It's all of these subcultures and that are typically associated with individual countries. And that when it comes together and intersects here is part of what has happened around Kansas City and kind of a lot of part where we are today.
Well, you know, Rick, you know, when we talk about the history of soccer, professional soccer in Kansas City, a lot of people do seem to start that story with the Wizards rather than with the Comets. Can you take me back to, like, what is it people are forgetting when they're forgetting about the Comets?
Well, I would even take a step back further. So the Spurs were part of the North American Soccer League, which, you know, Peter just referred to with the, you know, with the Cosmos. That was a league that I played in 76, which at that point was huge. The Cosmos, Minnesota Kicks, you know, there were some big teams, big attendances. And then that kind of went away. And then the indoor game came about. And Kansas City was again involved there with the Comets, and it was very successful. And then certainly now you see the evolution of the outdoor game again, from the Wizards to Sporting Kansas City. It's just really been amazing.
Yeah. How would you just, what would be your short version of the story of that arc as the Comets go away and then we have the Wizards and then in some ways the story reaches its peak with Sporting?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think again, kind of what Peter alluded to, I think it's a case of lots of different smaller percolations of people keeping the game alive, you know, from the indoor game to youth soccer to collegiate soccer to professional soccer. And then I think certainly now in the world, as the world gets hopefully continues to get smaller and we grow, and it just creates this, you know, combination of all those different things.
Is there a turning point that either of you would identify as like, this is when soccer stopped being the sport people are keeping alive to this is a sport that has a life of its own here in Kansas City?
I'm not sure there's a moment in time, but I will say that the history of it has, and I will say when Sporting won their championship back in 2013, that sort of put a marker in the town in terms of validating what it was. And it was differentiating it because a lot of the other professional sports team weren't doing as well. And so it caught appropriate attention, but they, in my opinion, made their mark on the fan experience. And all going back to the Cosmos, you know, the Cosmos did it as well, but the Comets, it was really about fan experience. And I think what we've done well here in the Midwest in this thing is creating and recognizing the users and participants and creating a really rich experience that nurtures that and now has created enough momentum that I think it will continue to flourish.
Let's talk to a caller. We've got John in Shawnee calling us at 816-235-2888. Hi, John.
Hello.
What can you share?
Hey, I can share just about anything I've got in my heart. Soccer was the greatest. My name is John Cochran, and I played, I started in 1967. And let's start with the thank yous. Thank yous for the Latinos, and thank you so much for the Latinos and the internationals. They were still around and playing in a league when I started and played ball. It was great. They were good. They were mentors of such. Thank you to John Latshaw. I believe he was the owner and financier of the Spurs. They were good. They were fun going down to Old Municipal Stadium and watching that green field and seeing them do their thing. And their last season, they played at Pembroke Hill, and I had season tickets. And although there were very few attendees, they were still good. They were still relevant. They still had teams.
Can you clarify something for me? You're talking about the Spurs, professional local team. They were playing on the fields at Pembroke Hill?
I had season tickets the last season they played. And that was the last, that was it. I don't know if it was 70, 71, 72, but they played on that field. And I remember it well because a lot of times they would kick the ball and it would go in Brush Creek. not that they were not under control, but that's where they played. I mean, I doubt if there were 100, 200 people there. But
what brought you? What brought you?
What brought me?
Yeah.
Well, I started playing in 1967. With the Shawnee Cougars. Thank you, Fred Armstrong, for putting that team together. And I just got hooked on soccer from there.
So you were part of the subculture.
Well, I was part of the subculture, yes, and still am.
Well, thank you, John, for those memories. Is there anything in particular that you want people to remember about the Spurs? Because it sounds like you have a firsthand memory that not a lot of people share.
Oh, I don't remember all that much. I remember Janos Hanek. He came. He played on the internationals team when the Spurs went away. He was a very good player, and they were good. They were fun. And another thing I want to say is, don't leave out women's soccer. They were good. The club teams, and I know. I'm sure Brookside has the women's side and they got the men's side.
Yeah.
But when they all started, it was a great social thing. I met my wife playing soccer.
Well, John, that is lovely.
It's a good thing. Soccer has been good to me and to Kansas City.
Well, thanks, John. So an enthusiastic caller, but also he brings up a good point. We should not forget about women's soccer. And until recently, we had a championship women's soccer team here in Kansas City. We had people on that team playing for the U.S. Olympic team. And arguably, Kansas City could have done more to make them feel at home.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think certainly it's disappointing that we lost FCKC. But, you know, the contribution on the women's side, really, as far as playing, is probably more dramatic than what the men have been able to do. You know, we've you know, produced like and continue to produce, wide pool of really talented women players.
And I think certainly at the youth level, in many respects, the girl participation is more than the boys. And a lot has to do with just, you know, the opportunities, although it's getting more competitive these days. And I think that going back to the advent of Title IX collegiately has opened those doors and created at least a greater purpose of sort of engagement at that youth level. But Girls are some of the most enthusiastic, and having two daughters that played the sport, that they're both a beauty and a challenge at the same time.
I want to turn to a caller by the name of Nicholas. Hi, Nicholas.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Hey, I just wanted to call in and speak for the thousands and thousands of kids that Coach Sloan has had the chance of helping develop over the years.
Wait, you know Coach Sloan pretty well.
I know him very well. I'd say he was a big part of my development growing up. So, hi, Dad.
Hello, Nicholas.
Hey, so I just, you know, I know that there's thousands and thousands of kids that that you've coached over the years that, you know, it's a huge part of who we've become. And, you know, the World Cup is always a nice reminder of all that, too, of all the memories at Brookside and going out to Arrowhead Stadium. It's just a trip. But, you know, I love you, Dad, and I know I speak for the thousands and thousands of kids that you have personally touched and helped develop in Kansas City, and we wouldn't be who we are without you. So thank you.
Thank you.
That's sweet.
Or is there time to get me on with this?
Oh, excuse me. Little technical glitch there. You know, I just... That was a touching moment from your son, but it kind of gets to the point of that youth sports are not 100% about the sport itself, but about this sort of like character development thing. And do you think that the culture around soccer does that in a particular way?
I think it can. And certainly when it's done out of the love, and most of the, you know, certainly in our league, there's so many volunteers that people are giving their time, their spare time, trying to bond with their children. At the end of the day, the sport is just the vehicle to create relationships. You actually don't go and stripe field at 5 a.m. because that's you want to care for the game. It's because you want to facilitate those things. And I without a doubt would agree that it's really a great tool to bring families and friends together, and as a common, really a very accessible way.
Let's talk to Howard. Howard in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Howard.
Hello. This has gone by basically unnoticed, but we had a 50-year anniversary because the great Pelé, who led Santos of Brazil, they played against the Kansas City Spurs here on July 4th, 1968, and it did draw 20,000 people. And, you know, the next morning, the Kansas City Star said, Pelé is all they say. And one more thing, there was a tireless worker for the Heart of America Soccer Association. He played for Phil Chevrolet, and the Latinos, Internationals, and Phil, they all had really good rivalries. His name was Kent Hughes, and he was a tireless worker for the Heart of America Soccer Association. And so I just wanted to say those two things, and thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks, Howard. You guys are both nodding your heads.
Yeah, you know, I think that's been, for me, the fun part of being involved in the sport has been just getting to know all these people. You know, when you guys talked about coming here, it was like overwhelming to try to think about the people that have been mentioned, and everyone has really contributed to the growth of the game here.
But this little detail about Pelé playing here?
Oh, no, and that was common. You know, I was fortunate. I got to be involved in a couple of those games, not here in Kansas City, but, in St. Louis and Chicago. And he was just such a unique ambassador for the game with this worldwide recognition.
Well, UMKC soccer coach Richard Benben, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Peter Sloan, one of the early organizers for the Brookside Soccer League, thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, the guy who turned a local city hall into a Nerf gun battlefield on the weekends. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now the newest thing in Fairway for kids' birthday parties is to head over to City Hall. When city business is not in session on weekends, City Hall opens up for Nerf gun wars and pizza. When I first heard about this, I had to know more about the city employee who came up with the idea. He's here now. Bryce Sokin is the director of Parks and Rec for the City of Fairway. Good morning, Bryce.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good. What gave you this idea?
Well, yeah, it's kind of outside the box, but that's kind of what Fairway does. We have so many people, the great rec departments around us that do a lot of cool and fun things, and we had to kind of distance ourselves and try to figure out something that was we could do that was unique. And so we looked at the space that we have, which, as you said, holds court, holds council meetings, and also holds Nerf guns, Nerf wars. So, you know, it was kind of outside the box, but we felt that it was something that we could let the kids decide on. They seem to be pretty enthusiastic. We all have kids.
So wait, how did you let the kids decide on this? Did you say like, okay, here's the building we have. We want to do something cool with it. And then you brought in a bunch of kids to tell you what to do?
Well, it's kind of funny. The city administrator is the previous Parks and Rec director, and his wife had brought his children in, and he has three kids, and they range from, I believe, kindergarten through third or fourth grade. And so we kind of watched them how they play. We originally had a gymnastics program, which we still do, but they kind of looked at this space, and they thought, man, this would have been great for our Nerf gun birthday party we had at home the other day. And so they started building forts with everything. And so anyway, we kind of let them just kind of watch them and see how they played. And it kind of came to us that, wow, this is something that maybe would be pretty unique.
Is everyone on board?
Yeah, we've had a lot of support. I mean, we've had, you know, over 300 people come to City Hall. And a lot of those are non-residents. So that wouldn't have otherwise stepped in Fairway at all, let alone the City Hall. So they've come and it's expanded to rentals and expanded to pool and just a lot of it's built off of this so far.
Are you a Nerf gun fan yourself?
You know, I think so. I would assume so. And definitely now so, watching the kids. I mean, it's funny to watch them that you think the younger age group is going to be the one that's going to be pretty apprehensive, but they're the ones that go after it, go charge, and they kind of take over the event. The older ones are the ones that kind of think it out and how to play it out. So it's I become more of a fan since starting the program. Yeah,
I have heard a rumor that you are very involved, like that you are personally there for these games.
Yeah, so far, I mean, we want to make sure it goes well, and so and it's also fun to see them. So we want to make sure that everything goes well for the event. So far, that's what's been happening. We didn't know how popular it would be. So eventually, if we'd get, you know, continue the rise on the popularity, then I think that we'll try to find somebody else to come in there and maybe to take over some of those part-time positions. But so far, I'm having a blast being there.
Is there a particular Nerf gun fight that stands out to you in the time you've been doing this?
Well, again, like the little ones. So we kind of let this evolve. We told them, we thought we would walk in and say, from 5 to 10 minutes, we're going to do introductions. From 10 to blah, 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 we're going to do this. And tried to really structure it out. I'm a fairly structured person. They blew all that up as soon as I walked in. They took over.
The kids.
They just said, we got it. Don't worry about it. Sit down. So basically, they took all of our gymnastics equipment and built forts by themselves. We didn't even know they were going to do that. They thought we'd just leave them there. So it's really been cool to see that the little ones are especially funny because they have no fear. So they run around and they're going crazy. And just the different games, I add a little bit here and there, but it's, don't get it wrong. They are the ones that make it work.
I would guess that a person who becomes a director of Parks and Recreation is someone who is passionate about recreation. And I mean, everyone likes recreation, but would you say that you have a passion? Like, tell me about how you became this person who...
Yeah, absolutely. So my dad is a park and rec director in the little town of Lyons, Kansas, in the middle of the state, home of the Lyons. And so I grew up in the gym. I literally would go, that was my daycare. I'd go and play basketball during the summers, and he would send me up to the gym, and I eventually started working there doing the ball field maintenance and everything. And so I really saw through my dad how many he communicated and connected with people in the community. He knows everyone by first name basis. So, you know, in Fairway, that's a really good opportunity. It's such a small town right in the middle of a huge metropolis. I'm getting to know a lot of people on a first name basis, and I think that's great to have that representation.
It seems like birthday parties would be a good way to be on a first name basis.
Oh yeah, yeah, we've got a lot of those, especially the pool as well. We're booking pool parties throughout the summer, so we have that. We have gymnastics parties as well, so it's definitely a busy time.
But as far as everyone being on board with this, I am kind of joking, but kind of not. Like, guns in City Hall. I know it's Nerf guns, but still, even just saying those two words together, guns and City Hall, I could imagine a person getting nervous.
I understand that, you know, and we looked at that, you know, we thought about that. It's so far from those realms. I mean, we are providing a place for kids to come and really have a safe place, because a lot of these kids, and what I've heard from parents so far is, well, we played outside, we played in our basement, we're getting hurt because of the confines of our basement. The outside, you're losing everything. When they wanted a place to play, and I think they've really made this their home. So I think it's more about the involvement with the community, with the kids that are plane there, not necessarily the other side.
How do you see the space differently now that you've started doing this? I mean, it must be such a different way to look at your workplace to see kids running around it with Nerf guns as opposed to during the week, you were saying, like courts in session.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a lot of programs going on there. It's and I think our staff has enjoyed it for the most part. When those Nerf events come in, we definitely have a lot of sound in City Hall. And so we do have to close some doors to make sure that staff can actually get their job done. But it's and I'd say that in jest, but they've really welcomed it as well. And I would want them to let me know if they didn't otherwise. But it's definitely has been a different experience from our previous City Hall that we didn't have the space to be able to use.
Maybe I'm reading too much into this, but like on a serious note, the idea, this is a very American idea of government of for and by the people. And the idea of open, like very literally opening up the doors to the halls of government to children. I mean, you could say like, these are not voters yet. These are not, you know what I mean? It is symbolically a very interesting decision to me.
Yeah. This is Fairway Space. This is their City Hall. This is, absolutely what they would like to use it for. So we want to make sure that we are opening that space and providing that space to do other activities. We just had a little 5-year-old and 11-year-old do our art contest, and they got presented with an award at our city council. So I think that opening the doors up and letting them use the space and see the space that we have to use, I think if we didn't use it, that would be a bigger problem at this point.
Is there a precedent for this at other city halls?
Not in Lyons, Kansas. As far, you know, a lot of other places have gyms, they have wellness areas, they have, different facilities that are, that's specifically what they're for. This was, you know, we had to really think outside the box for City Hall. So, and I'm so glad that the council was able to allow us the multipurpose use of that space, because that is absolutely what it is multipurpose. There's, like, again, we go back to yoga and city council and Nerf events. So, I mean, it's the whole gamut every week.
So really paint this picture for me. It's a Saturday, for example. Some kids got a birthday party at City Hall. What happens?
Well, I usually typically show up about an hour before, get it all set up, order the pizzas, and then they show up and they're ready to go. Everybody always asks, should we eat first or should we go play? And you're not going to get a kid to sit down and actually eat for 30 minutes while they have all this waiting for them. So they go play immediately, and they have a great time for about an hour. I'm there again just to kind of help facilitate it. They really run the show.
Do you ever have to be like a referee type person?
Yeah, we have a lot of those. I got you. No, you got me. You know, that type thing. But, for the most part, the kids have been great, and they almost govern themselves during these times. So, in the game. And so, my goal is just to get them to, stop when we're supposed to stop, get the pizza to them, get the snacks to them, get the ice cream to them, which all comes in the package, and send them on their way to have a great remainder of their birthday.
You've talked about that your dad was a director of a Parks and Recreation department in Kansas, and that you grew up kind of within the Parks and Recreation department yourself. Can you share a favorite memory from growing up that way?
You know, I think that the favorite memory, I think we always used to host baseball tournaments in the summer, and that was kind of the end of the summer thing. We'd always host a big tournament, and I think just having people come to, you know, small town, little Lyons, Kansas, and say, "Wow, you guys did it right." You know, the lines were straight, the lawn was cut, the infield was cut, everything was taken care of, every little aspect was taken care of, and that was the direct result of my dad putting a ton of hours. So
it sounds like it was a point of pride for the town.
Absolutely, I still wear that pride if you couldn't tell, but yes, absolutely.
What do you think that means to a town to have a Parks and Recreation department doing things, seemingly simple things like painting the lines straight?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it just shows attention to detail. I mean, and again, we have to be very unique in Fairway because we're so small. We have a lot of people around us that are doing a lot of fun things. So we have to make our mark in this area.
Well, Bryce Sokin, Director of Parks and Recreation for the City of Fairway, thank you so much for being here, and keep us posted on how the Nerf gun battles on the weekends evolve.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Our time is up, but you can listen back to either of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. In case you missed something or just want to share it with a friend, we spent most of the hour talking about the history of soccer in Kansas City the day after this year's World Cup ended. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the suburbs have gotten a bad rap in literature. There's always a dark secret behind a too pleasant veneer, or everyone's wallowing in the blandness of the color beige. But is that all there is to the suburbs in literature and in life? You tell me tomorrow at 10 with the Bibliophiles on KCUR. Today's episode of Central Standard was produced by KCUR's Suzanne Hogan with help from intern Trevor Hook. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.